And I'll go ahead and call up the presentation materials because we are ready to get started with our session today. So as I pull up the presentation content, I'm going to put Stuart's video here on the screen. And Stuart, whenever you are ready, I'll turn the floor over to you to officially begin your presentation today.
Okay. Thank you, Jean. Can you hear me?
I can.
All right. I guess we're good then. Hello, I'm Stuart Walker, with the Office of Superfund Remediation Technology Innovation. And I guess we can get started now on the on this webinar. So this disclaimer is basically this is my presentation. It's not an official EPA policy, even though I'm citing a lot of officially paid policies. So that's just a standard disclaimer. And so first talk. So EPA addresses site cleanup or contaminated site cleanup under several laws and programs. This talk is going to focus on how we clean up under the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act, or CERCLA, what a lot of people call Superfund, particularly for how we deal with radionuclides. So that's our law. Our regulation that provides the framework is the National Contingency Plan, or NCP, that implements CERCLA cleanups. And the National Priorities List, or NPL, guides EPA remedial program on which sites need further attention. Those are often thought of as Superfund sites, but so the purpose today is to describe our framework from EPA for addressing radioactively contaminated Superfund sites. So I'll provide a brief description of the CERCLA remedial program process overall, and then provide overview and comparison of some of the key EPA CERCLA remedial program guidance and tools that specifically address cleanup of radionuclides. Should note here, though, that radionuclides are addressed with other hazardous substances under general EPA CERCLA guidelines. CERCLA. So we have two types of actions, removal actions and remedial. Removal actions tend to be short-term response actions, and they are broken out into three categories. So emergency tend to be things where you're taking action within, say, 48 hours. Time critical, within months, and non-time critical could be longer time period. Those are actually also addressed by the remedial program at headquarters. And then remedial are the longer term response actions, the focus of this talk. And these are the sites that when you're taking remedial action, there's often on the NPL for sites, and although those may have removals on part of the site too. So what does a Superfund site look like? So there are many different types of Superfund sites. So the following four pages just give some examples of radioactively contaminated Superfund sites. So there's a wide depth of range of types of sites. So nuclear metals, this is in Massachusetts, depleted uranium site. And the Navajo Nation Abandoned Uranium Project, so that's roughly around 500 sites and spread over the Navajo Nation, large area. Across four states. And then Welsbach General Gas Mantle, so dealing with thorium gas mantles in New Jersey. And last example, the DOE site, Hanford. So you can see there's a wide variety that Superfund radioactively contaminated sites can look very different from each other and have di different circumstances. So how does EPA address radiation in the Superfund program, which is essentially a chemical cleanup program? So on the NPL, there's only approximately like 66, maybe 67 now radioactively contaminated NPL sites out of 1,789 total. So the focus of the Superfund remedial program has always been on chemicals. So the question, how best to address radiation then? So the answer that we came up with decades ago was address radiation in a consistent manner with how we address chemicals, except to account for the technical differences posed by radiation. Why is this? Well, we think radiation easily fits within the Superfund framework. We're already radionuclides. We're generally worrying about chemical risk. The cancer risk, and we're already dealing with a lot of chemical carcinogens at sites. Matter of fact, at all of our NPL sites with radioactive contamination, there's also chemical contamination. So this also helps improve public confidence by taking some of the mystery out of dealing with radiation. For those of you who have dealt with radiation sites or radiation other aspects, you'll find that the public is often much more afraid of radiation than even chemicals with similar risks. And as mentioned before, yeah, radioactively contaminated NPL sites also have chemical contamination. Besides, starting to get into the slide on the last slide. So why do we radiation easily fit within the Superfund remedial programs framework? As I mentioned, the primary effect is cancer. We're already dealing with chemical carcinogens. Also, when the contamination is mixed together, when people are going to ingest, inhale, eat the same amount of contaminated dust and food, whether it's chemical or radioactive contamination. So we should model those things in a similar manner. Dust gets resuspended the same, whether it's chemically or radioactively contaminated. And inorganic elements move to the subsurface, whether they're radioactive or not. Most radionuclides that we're dealing with are metals, so we're already looking at metals at sites and how they move through the subsurface. So, part one, go to regulatory framework. Gina, we're going to ask questions at this point.
Yeah, at this time, Stuart, I don't have any specific questions that came in, just some general goals of what people were hoping that you might cover today. I will take this moment just to let those of you who have asked about slides. Slides are already posted on the seminar homepage. I'll put that link for everyone in the chat. And today's session will be recorded, so you can replay this later on. And Stuart, I say carry on, and then we'll pause again briefly for questions in just a few moments.
Okay, sounds good to me. So at the CERCLA, we'll go through the nine criteria for CERCLA remedy selection. And so these are when you're looking at alternatives, how they're evaluated. So there are two threshold criteria. Both must be met by any alternative for it to go further in the process. One is protect human health and the environment. I'll talk more about that later. And the other is comply, which means either attain or waive with other federal and state environmental laws. So these are known as applicable or relevant and appropriate requirements, or we call ARRs. Now, applicable requirements are those that you would have to meet whether you were a Superfund site or not. Relevant and appropriate, which is a nuanced, different thing that you'll see in the under CERCLA than you see under most other statutes, you have to do a site-specific determination on whether the substantive portions of a regulation or law are considered both relevant to the circumstance at your site and appropriate. And then those substantive requirements, which were called ARRs, would need to be met or waived as if they were applicable. And that would only cover the substantive portions, not administrative requirements. So the classic example is we protect current or future sources of drinking water, so known as the maximum contaminant limits or MCLs, or more stringent state standards, in groundwater as a potential source of drinking water, even though those standards are applicable at when treated by public water systems. So we actually, in Superfund, we will find them relevant and appropriate for the groundwater itself. Having trouble moving the slide. Hold on a second. Oh, there we go. So there are six ARR waivers under CERCLA. And so we'll go through those. And these apply both for radionuclide standards that are ARRs, but also chemicals. So there's interim measure. So if this is an earlier action and you might not meet the ARR at that moment, but you intend on meeting it later, if the action will cause greater risk to human health and the environment, if it's technically impracticable, and that generally means from an engineering perspective to meet the standard If you can also get to the same level of performance through a different methodology that's equivalent standard of performance. If it's a state requirement and they're not consistently applying it at other sites that they want to apply it at a Superfund site, that would be a consistent application of state requirements. And also fund balancing, which we did not have a fund for a while. Now we have a fund. If this is going to cause a lot of inordinate amount of expenditure of the fund for this one action, then it might be way for fund balancing reasons. Still usable. So the after a criteria gets through the two threshold criteria, then it's evaluated using the five balancing criteria. So these are long-term effectiveness and permanence. So how's it the is the action going to work over the long term? Also, the reduction of waste toxicity, mobility, or volume. With radionuclides, you can't really reduce the toxicity of them. You can stabilize them to reduce their mobility, or you can sometimes reduce the amount of contaminated material to get the volume down before you dispose of it. I will just say one thing on radionuclides. When you start running our risk assessment tools, they have both activity and mass. You will see that the cleanup levels in terms of mass tend to be really low. So a lot of the technologies that work for metals, for say volume reducing, will not work for radionuclides when you're trying to get down to cleanup levels. That's just because the mass is really low for radionuclides at the same level of risk. Third one is short-term effectiveness, and this is looking at adverse impacts of or potential adverse impacts from taking a certain remedial approach, then how well you can implement it is fourth, and then we also look at cost fifth. Now, and the last two we call the modifying criteria out of the nine circle remedy section criteria come. When you look at the regulation, they are discussed as far as criteria that you would use after information from the public comment period that then may modify the remedial action, and that is state acceptance and community acceptance. But I'll say that's the way the regulation is written. As you work through the process at a CERCLA site, you should actually be looking and communicating with the state, working with them and the community at the site to find out what's acceptable, because you don't want to find out after have that be news after you've proposed a certain action. So although these are written as showing up at the end of the remedy selection criteria, our experience has shown that we really need to think about these things all the way through the process. So as far as cleanup levels, ARRs often determine cleanup levels. Where they're not available or sufficiently protective, EPA sets site-specific cleanup levels. So for carcinogens like radionuclides, these represent an increased cancer risk, 1 × 10⁻⁶ to 1 × 10⁻⁴, and that is 1 in 1 million people to 1 in 10,000 people generally. Maybe a little bit higher than the top of that risk range. 10⁻⁶ is used at our point of departure. PRGs, or preliminary remediation goals, are established for carcinogens usually at 1 × 10⁻⁶. For non-carcinogens, we look at impacts that will not result in any adverse effects to human health. And for that, we use a hazard index and the level, if it exceeds the hazard H index or HI, where contaminant exceeds one, that's not protective then. So we also address ecological concerns, generally species protection, and to be considered materials such as guidance documents I'll talk about, or the risk assessment calculators, the models we use that may help determine cleanup levels. So what are CERCLA cleanup levels not based on? So if you put this slide in, because a lot of people have experience dealing with radiation, but in other programs, unlike CERCLA. So the NRC decommissioning requirements, are basically 25 and 100 millirem dose limits under 10 CFR Part 20, Subpart E. These are used as an ARR. 10⁻⁶ is still used as a point of departure, and 10⁻⁴ to 10⁻⁶ risk range must still be met. using a risk assessment, so you don't disconvert from dose. Guidance outside the risk range, or if it expressed a dose, such as millirem or millisieverts per year, is not also used. This includes DOE orders, NRC guidance, which are called DOREGs, but they're guidance, ICRP guidance, and IAEA guidance from an international approach, and NCRP, ANSI, Health Physics Society, and even the EPA, DHS PAGS, and federal guidance. Now, a lot of these sources that we don't use are risk management framework. If you are using our risk assessment models and you go to the user guide into the reference section, you'll see that we're using a lot of the same underlying science, but we are using a different risk management approach to make sure that we are consistent with how we address chemicals at the same site. So let's go through some common radiation ARARs. So there is a standard for radium and thorium in soil under 40 CFR Part 182. This is under UMTRCA, which is the Uranium Mill Tailings Radiation Control Act. These standards are 5 picocuries over background. And I will say that the standard we used to use a lot as an ARAR at sites, but probably now most of the radium thorium sites are probably using RISC rather than this ARAR. There's also a standard for radon in buildings. It's 0.02. This is also from UMTRCA. 0.02 working levels of radon 220 and 222 decay products. This differs a little bit from the public home limits for homes for radon, but that's a guidance. And since this is a standard, we use this as an ARAR, so that's what we use at Superfund sites. And for outdoor radon, again, under UMTRCA standard, and also under the Clean Air Act, under 40 CFR Part 61, is 20 picocuries per meter square of radon 222. So, when we're looking at on-site waste management, we may also use the NRC low-level waste standard that's under 10 CFR Part 61, which came out under the Atomic Energy Act. That's 25 millirem. Whole body, 75 millirem to the thyroid, and 25 millirem to any critical organ other than a thyroid. I would like to point out that this is a completely different dose methodology than the 2500 millirem NRC decommissioning standard. So it actually equates to a lower dose if you were looking at it in terms of more modern methods, probably more like 10 millirem. We also look at state water quality standards. And continuing the common radionuclide ARARs, we have the federal drinking water MCLs, which are under 40 CFR Part 141, and they're issued under the Safe Drinking Water Act. So there's 5 picocuries per liter of radium 226 and 228 combined. So then there is a 4 millirem from beta particles and photon emitters, the total body or any internal organ. I will say that for that 4 millirem standard, you don't actually do a dose assessment. There are already concentrations that are issued by the Office of Water that correspond to 4 millirem, and those are the concentrations you use when you're complying with the ARAR. You're also for gross alpha particle activity, there's 15 picocuries per liter standard. This excludes radon and uranium. And then there's a 30 micrograms per liter standard for total uranium. So that one's in terms of mass instead of activity. So it's not picocuries, it's micrograms. That's looking at uranium as a kidney toxin, if you're wondering why it's in different units. And then there's also uranium and groundwater standard under UMTRCA, again, 40 CFR Part 192. And that's 30 picocuries per liter of uranium 234 and 238 combined. And if there are state MCLs that are more stringent than the federal. So I guess we're at the end of that part, G. I don't know if you want to see if there's any questions.
Sure, we do have a few questions that came in. This first one, if you could just reinforced, do Superfund cleanups need to comply with NRC requirements, for example, that 100 millirems per year?
Not really. They generally are not selected as ARRs, but if they are selected as an ARR, then you would have to do a dose assessment to show 100 millirem. But the fact that you would also need to do a risk assessment and starting at 10 to minus 6 and make sure you fall within the risk range at 10 to minus 4, that's going to be the driver, not 100 millirem. So.
Okay. Another participant noted that they have a question on the integration between EPA and then NRC state methodologies. They note that many states have delegated authority from the NRC to regulate radioactive material usage and remediate it, but they're also unfamiliar with EPA methodologies under CERCLA. They were wondering if you could discuss what MOAs EPA has with the NRC regarding radioactive cleanup under CERCLA sites.
We do have an MOU with NRC, and it's more for when NRC is decommissioning their sites, and that is that they would consult with us if their soil concentrations appear to be outside of our cancer risk range, or they appear that they will have groundwater levels that might exceed our MCLs. That's because those might be reasons that we might want to list the site later. So by cooperating with each other, we may be able to work with them, and they can also tell the licensee things that they might do to avoid Superfund listing in the future. As far as we do sometimes work on sites together, there may be a site that still has an NRC license that we've listed for some other reason. We may need to coordinate as we do the cleanup. That's more site specific. But generally, I can say that at the end of the day, the Superfund standards will need to be met, and for NRC to terminate a license, their standards will be need to be met. So we'll try to coordinate so we don't clean up the same area twice, but make sure that we both are meeting it. And that's something worked out more with the regions. Yeah, I think that probably answers it. I'm sorry.
Okay. No, it's okay. We have just a quick clarification. One of the attendees noted, I thought the federal MCL for uranium was 20 picocuries per liter and not 30. It is, and then they say it is 30 ppb.
Yeah, micrograms. No, it's not the federal MCL for uranium is not in picocuries.
Okay.
There was a proposal that never was finalized, and I believe it's maybe from 1994. They looked at it, and I can't remember what the proposal was. I don't remember if it was 20 or 30 picocuries per liter, but they ended up going with mass for the final rule that came out December 7th, 2000.
Okay, we had a question. What if NRC 10, CFR 40, Appendix A, is an ARAR?
I'll get to that later.
Okay, all right. Then our next question, do Superfund cleanups need to comply with MRSM?
Have to know MRSM is not actually a recommended guidance, but we do cite it in the risk assessment Q&A that will be discussed later. And because it's cited in there, the regions don't have to consult with headquarters when they are using MRSM as a survey tool. They don't have to, we don't, so in that guidance, if you're trying to use a guidance that's not mentioned in the risk assessment Q&A, there is a consultation requirement for the regions to talk with headquarters. But although we don't recommend that you need to use it at every site or argue when you're not using it, we do think it's a good tool. So we mention it in the Q&A so that way regions don't need to consult with us when they actually use it.
Okay. We do have a few questions about radon, and this is a very specific question, so I'm going to take this one and then we might carry on, but we will pause again for a Q&A break again in a few moments. One of the attendees noted that the EPA residential guidance for radon in IA is 4 picocuries per liter.
Right.
They then say it was noted that the 0.02 working levels for radon from UMTRCA was a bit different and can also be an ARAR. They wonder how do those 0.02 working levels compare? Is there an easy conversion from working levels to picocuries per liter?
At the time that the UmTrica standard was issued, I believe they were generally considered to, on average, to equate to about the same thing.
Okay.
But as we get a little bit more understanding too with radon and the K products that we use for the 0.02 working levels, that can change. So a given level of radon can have a different level of the progeny, or what people often call the daughter products, depending on things like the air exchange rate in that building. So they don't basically considered a lot closer. They may or may not match up as much, at least in our thought process now. Probably on average, they're probably fairly close, but they were almost, I think, at the time when the standards were being issued, and the guidance came and the public guidance came out, I believe they were considered just about the same. But also, there's more thoughts on air exchange rates at sites and more studies now that show that they don't always match up quite as much.
Okay. And can you let the audience know where they could find out about any national action levels that might exist for radon?
EPA, the Office of Radiation and Indoor Air, they have a series of radon websites that talk about the public guidance. I don't know those off the top of my head. I know I'm going to talk about the RVISL calculator in a few slides. I know in the facts, in the frequently asked questions, we have questions that link back to those, the indoor radon program, because people do ask there about more detail on how they differ. And then we send people back to the indoor radon slides.
Okay. All right. I see this other question. I apologize. We're going to take one last one. Do you typically include 10 CFR Part 20 for protection of workers and members of the public during the period with which CERCLA activities involving radioactive materials are being conducted? And they comment, it seems like the majority of what you have included are standards that would apply at the end of the remedial activities, not during the remedial activities.
Right. So protection of workers doing response actions. So for chemicals, that's generally OSHA, and for radionuclides, that would generally be the NRC standards, or sometimes OSHA standards also. Those are not ARARs, so they're not environmental standards. So those are things that we might be meeting while we're doing the action, but they're not actually part of this. They're not actually part of CERCLA. So there are
Okay.
things you would still meet when you're at a site, so you might still have OSHA requirements, so your remediation workers are safe, but that's not considered part of those worker protection standards are not considered part of CERCLA. They're not ARARs. They're things you're meeting just because the OSHA exists, or if you have NRC or OSHA radiation standards you need to meet also besides the chemicals. Or sometimes in NIOSH, you would need to meet those, but they're not part of the CERCLA ARR. So that's why I'm not talking about this.
Okay. All right. I think what we'll go ahead and do then is just take a pause here and let Stuart carry on the presentation. We still have some additional questions in the queue, and I see a few more coming in. We will pause again for Q&A break. We have a few of those breaks planned. So, Stuart, I'll turn the floor back to you and just encourage the audience to keep sending those questions and comments on in.
Okay. So it's part two. So talk about the guidance and models that we issued for EPA staff to implement CERCLA. And so why do we issue these? So site consistency. So we issue these guidance and models to help facilitate compliance with the NCP and clean up sites. So we provide things like guidance documents, risk assessment or dose assessment models, which are called calculators, various training, both internal and also things like training today that helps people both inside EPA and outside EPA. We've also done a lot of, I've done similar training with this back with the U.S. state-led ITRC group. We did several trainings with them on radiation. And I've also done a series of 8-hour classroom classes on radiation risk assessment with Oak Ridge National Laboratory. I think we've done like 47 or 48 of those. And then we do internally, we do annual meetings with our EPA regions. Those are basically internal meetings, plus going out to different conferences. But the guidance and models and we had some of our training are available for free on the internet. So I'm gonna start going through some of the CERCLA guidance documents. So in 1997, August 22nd, we issued establishment of cleanup levels for CERCLA sites with radioactive contamination. So that guidance document was clearly saying that radioactive contaminants at CERCLA sites are governed by the NCP, like all other contaminants. And it specifically mentioned things like cleanups that are based on ARRs or the risk range. Groundwater should be restored to beneficial reuse. And under cleanups, we use a reasonably anticipated land use. We're doing things like risk-based cleanups. That's different than, say, NRC that often uses unrestricted release for almost everything. So, UMTRCA soil ARR. So, I mentioned this one earlier, but we also have a guidance on interpreting it. So, it's use of soil cleanup criteria in 40 CFR Part 192 as remediation goals for CERCLA sites. I always love these scintillating titles. So, this is a guidance on radium and thorium subsurface soil cleanup levels. So, the guidance talks about you need to attain 5 picocuries, not 15 picocuries in the subsurface. So, the standard's written that there's a 15 picocuries is a standard in the when you look at the UMTRCA regulation in 40 CFR 192. And that 15 picocuries was used as a finding tool at UMTRCA sites where subsurface contamination was considered to be high. Basically, they didn't have anything in the subsurface between 5 and 30 picocuries per gram. It was generally much higher than that. So it was expected they could use a 15 as a finding tool to achieve 5 picocuries or less and save money on site survey costs. So therefore, the 15 picocuries per gram standard is relevant and appropriate CERCLA sites only when it's going to achieve 5 picocuries or less. That's the main gist of this guidance. Also, risk-based cleanup levels for radioactive contamination are expressed as risk levels, not millirem or millisieverts. So we use slope factors, risk coefficients instead of dose conversion factors to estimate cancer risk from radioactive contaminants. So those slope factors are then in the EPA PRG risk assessment models. In 2014, we issued the Radiation Risk Assessment at CERCLA Sites Q&A, provides an overview of current EPA guidance for CERCLA radiation risk assessment written for users familiar with Superfund, but not radiation. To mention, this is an update to the Radiation Risk Assessment Q&A that came out in 1999. So it updated policies based on newer science. So in this one, we talked about complying with UMTRCA indoor radon standards and ARRAR. Users may assume the following concentrations correspond to 0.2 working levels. However, this has been updated. So this policy has now been superseded by using the RVISL calculator, which gives you a better ability to come up with more site-specific correlation between the radon levels and the working levels. But one thing that's still in play is the risk assessment Q&A talked about that reiterating more strongly that risk assessments the models use should be consistent with the models used for chemicals at that site and other regional sites. So don't use a steady state model for chemicals and a transfer dynamic model for radionuclides. So, for example, if you use the RSL calculator for chemicals, that's a steady state model, which assumes that the contamination that is in the soil is not depleting as far as running off into surface water, going to the subsurface. So it's a conservative method, and we use that because we're using RME, so we're trying to protect the more highly exposed individual. Whereas you use, say, the DOE ResRad tool, it defaults towards using the transfer dynamic approach, which is a source depleting. So that is a something you should avoid trying because we're trying to protect the same receptor at the same site from in a consistent manner for chemicals and radionuclide cancer risk, since we will be adding the cancer risk together. Also, the Q&A talks about more consistency on site surveys, both for characterization and confirmation, should be consistent with chemicals at a site and with other regional sites. So again, don't use not to exceed for chemicals and area averaging for radionuclides. I mentioned this was coming up in a lot of sites that were going in front of our expert group called the Remedy Review Board. So if the site was, say, in a residential area, we usually use not to exceed, say, because we're worried that a receptor may stay on one spot much of the day. Like the kids may play in one area if they have a playground set, or someone may garden in one area and spend a lot of time there. Area averaging, generally for more restricted land uses where you think the person is going to move around, maybe it might be an outdoor workplace where somebody's not staying in one spot, but they're working around the whole grounds. So this would sometimes be a problem because we'd be used not to exceed for chemicals, but because MRSA includes an AA or the area averaging approach, and sometimes people thought they had to use that because it's in there for the radionuclides, and said no, you can still use other parts of MRSIM and just not use the area averaging approach if you're using not to exceed for that site. But basically, the guidance is just calling for consistency on when you use not to exceed or and area averaging for both chemicals and radionuclides at the same site, because it's more based on the land use and thinking the behavior of the receptor, whether they're going to be in one location or not. It's not because of whether it's chemical or radioactive contamination. So it should be based on the receptor, not the contaminant. Getting to other guidance documents. So there is a soil screening guidance for radionuclides that came out in 2000. This is similar to ones that came out for chemicals earlier. There's both a user guide and a technical background document, or TBD. And so this guidance was used to screen out areas, pathways, and radionuclides early in the process, consistent with the 1996 chemical soil screening guidance. Equations look at 1 × 10⁻⁶ for soil, and also protecting groundwater from having soil leaching from the soil into the groundwater and exceeding the maximum contaminant levels, or MCLs. It had one land use, residential land use, survey procedures for site characterization. Did evaluate 5 more sophisticated soil to groundwater models and accounted for some of the technical differences of radiation. So this one included external radiation, where the updated version of the soil screening guide for chemicals has went with dermal. And then that also had a calculator, but that's been superseded by the new by the more newer, now old, radionuclide PRG calculator, which is used to establish PRGs when ARRs are either not available or sufficiently protective. So if they're, say, an ARR is, say, 25 millirem or really more than 12 millirem, then you would need to use a risk assessment. So this includes electronic equations, both again risk and leach into groundwater, 10⁻⁶ and MCLs. Also accounting for technical difference posed by radiation. So gamma, we get more information on plant uptake, so it also includes things like gardening and farm animals. So the radionuclide PRG calculator has 10 scenarios or land uses available in it. The residential, agricultural, indoor workers, outdoor workers, fish ingestion, tap water, soil to groundwater, air, recreator, and a construction worker. I will say though that if you're looking also at the chemical toxicity of total uranium, you would also look at the chemical RSL calculator for that. But the cancer risk for the uranium isotopes, you would be looking at using the PRG calculator. And originally we developed some internet-based training with the state's ITRC on the calculator and radiation risk assessment years ago. And that's also been updated with the 8-hour classes we do. So we also have a dose calculator similar to the PRG calculator. It's called the Dose Compliance Concentrations, or DCC, for dose limit ARRs. Again, it has the same tenants and errors and land uses that the PRG calculator has, so I won't read through those. Equations in it are similar to those in the PRG calculator, except it accounts as dose conversion factors are used instead of the slope factors. The PRG and DCC calculators give a little more detail on their produce. They have tw 25 specific subcategories of produce. 23 are used in the default mode. They're listed there. The ones in yellow, the two in yellow, cereal grains and rice, are the ones that are not clicked on in default mode, but you can click them on. And then for each of the categories of produce, they have their own mass loading factors for how much dirt would be expected to have been on the in contact with that plant and then have transferred contamination onto the plant. That's also, and then there's children and adult ingestion rates for all 25 of these categories, both for fresh weight, if site is sensitive subpopulations, and more typical ingestion rate with cooking and preparation loss. So they also have the user is also able to select, looking at plant, the root uptake into plants, four climate zones, temperate, subtropical, tropical, and humid, and then seven default soils that are in there. So these use there are climate specific and soil type specific transfer factors for root uptake for many of the elements that are available from IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency. And so if you pick the correct climate zone and soil type, and there's a more specific transfer factor for that, then that correct factor will be selected. If not, then it'll just use the one that was in the default. So also, more information on the farmer resident categories. So you're able to show the individual produce category output. So that helps you see which type of produce or which farm animal is driving the rooming selection. So you may want to get more information on how much people actually eat of those at that particular site. And the farmer, there's 10 animal products. So beef, dairy, swine, poultry, eggs, finfish, shellfish, goat milk, goat meat, and sheep meat. And again, you have child and adult ingestion rates for all 10 of these categories, both fresh weight and also those with factoring in with cooking and preparation loss. In the farmer scenario, when you select poultry, you can also select four types of poultry. This changes the ingestion intake rates for the farm animal. So, how much food they actually eat, the fodder, how much water they actually drink, and how much soil they accidentally ingest while they're eating their food. So, there's also a building PRG or BPRG calculator. And let me take a little sip here. This is used to establish 10 to minus 6 risk-based PRGs for the reuse of radioactively contaminated buildings. I should stress that again, it's the reuse of the building. It's not for knocking the building down and then figuring out what the risk is when you dispose of the contaminated material. So the equations and parameters are derived from the latest EPA chemical methodology. So that was generally the World Trade Center assessment. They're adjusted to account for technical differences posed by radiation. So that is for the dust. We started with the dust assessment that had been used after World Trade Center assessment. This has been updated a couple times just because there's been new data in the Exposure Factors Handbook. So the agency committed to spending time and money to try and get better data on dust ingestion after doing the risk assessment for the World Trade Center. And so we've incorporated that newer material. And we also did a internet-based training on the BPRG calculator with ITRC. So the BPRG calculator has two land use scenarios, residential and indoor worker, and then both land uses use three exposure media. So settled dust, ambient air, and then a direct external exposure. So that's fixed contamination on the walls, the floor, and the ceiling. They're looking at five room sizes and four receptor locations, looking at both surface and volumetric contamination. Then we have a dose-based version of the BPRG calculator called the BDCC. It does the same thing, same land uses. It just does showing your dose from the contamination or a target or using a target dose limit to show concentration comply with that rather than target risk that's in the BPRG calculator. Again, using slope factor, this uses dose conversion factors instead of slope factors. So in both the BPRG and BDC calculators, there are seven room materials for each receptor location and room sizes. So we use Adobe composite one room material, drywall room, glass windows, wooden doors, drywalls, concrete floor, drywall ceiling, composite two room materials, concrete room, wooden doors, concrete floor, drywall ceiling. There's concrete, drywall, glass, and wood. We'll be expanding the choices in this calculator, hopefully later on this year. We just finished an analysis to add to the BPRG calculator to give people more choices. And the outdoor surfaces are SPRG calculator. That's to establish a risk-based PRG 10 to minus 6 for radioactively contaminated outside hard surfaces. So this is slabs, pavement, sidewalks, and sides of building. And a lot of this was derived from the PRG and BPRG calculators. So the SPRG has three land use scenarios: so residential, indoor worker, outdoor worker. It has three exposure media, so you have settled dust, paved and unpaved street level. So this dust, besides having windblown resuspension that you see in the PRG calculator, it also has mechanical resuspension, which is things like trucks and cars kicking up the dust into the air, as you can see from the little pretty picture there, showing kind of describing the conceptual site model. And then we have fixed direct external 3D street level, so both surface and volumetric. So that's contamination that's sorbed or built into the things like the sidewalks or the building slab. And then, oh, 3D, I'm sorry, is going up the side of the building too, so the different heights. And 2D is building slab, again, surface and volumetric. So we have a dose-based version of that calculator called the SDCC, same land uses, same exposure media, and again, using dose conversion factors instead of slope factors. So to more briefly, the mechanically driven particulate emission factor, or PEF, that's in the SPRG and SDCC, the default's based on the California Urban Highway. You have other choices, so you can have state specific. So you pick up the state you're in, and then whether it's urban or rural, and then seven different roadway classes, and then either you can go to site specific, and then you have choices of paved or unpaved, and there you have to put information on your traffic if you go site specific, and then that will give you a more better estimate of the amount of dust that's going to be resuspended from traffic. So, the state specific. So, you pick your state again, like say, urban or rural, and then I'm sorry, six choices. So, under urban, it's interstate, freeways and expressways, other principal arterial, minor arterial, collector and local, rural, interstate, other principal arterial, minor arterial, major collector, minor collector, and local collector. This scheme of state specific and basing estimates from traffic data in those states is something that we took from our non-point source portion of the Clean Air Act. So we talked with the folks that run that program and tried to bring in their type of model into the SPRG calculator. And for determining your road class, there is a DOT map. It's actually changing the map, so it's not doesn't look quite like this. Not ready to update this slide. DOT changed that in the last year, right? But they still have a system where you can pick your roadway class. You used to have paper maps, and the roads were all different colors. That those colors correlate to the classifications that were on the previous slide. And getting to radon. So there is a radon vapor intrusion screening level tool called the RVISL. And this is the internet calculator tool, again, to provide concentrations of radon and thorium in soil and groundwater that will not result in radon intrusion into buildings that exceed target levels. So this looks at indoor radon 222, 220, and 219. And target gives target level concentrations based on risk. Default to 1 × 10⁻⁶, but and then also the UNTRACA standard for looking at compliance for radon 222 and 220 corresponding to 0.02 working levels, and also dose default to 1 millirem. Also, there is another guidance for EPA for monitor natural attenuation for inorganics. Policy document issued in 2015. This helped complement the 1999 overall M&A policy document and helps clarify some of the policy issues that were unique to inorganics that were not really addressed in the 1999 overall document. And there is a three-volume set of documents from our Office of Research and Development on M&A for radionuclides and chemicals that serve as a technical support document for this policy document. So the three technical reports from ORD, often lovingly referred to as the trilogy, for monitor natural attenuation of inorganic contaminants in groundwater. So volume one was the technical basis for assessment, came out in 2007. At the same time, or similar time, Volume 2, assessment for non-radionuclides, including arsenic, cadmium, chromium, copper, lead, nickel, nitrate, poi, and selenium, came out in 2007. And a few years later, Volume 3 came out, which was the M&A assessment for radionuclides, including americium, cesium, iodine, plutonium, radium, radon, strontium, technetium, thorium, tritium, and uranium. In some other guidance documents that deal with groundwater, there is the use of uranium drinking water standards under 40 CFR Part 141, that's the MCLs, and then under 40 CFR 192, that's UNTRACA, as remediation goals for groundwater at surface sites. So basically looking at the guidance on how you interpret using MCLs and UNTRACA uranium standards as ARARs for groundwater. So when both standards are ARARs, you must attain or waive both. So that means a 30 micrograms per liter of total uranium and a 30 picocuries per liter of uranium-234 and 238 combined. So you need to look at those, make sure they're both being complied with. The UNTRACA standard uses a different point of compliance. This guidance says just use the MCL ARAR point of compliance even for the UNTRACA standard. It's more conservative. And it also includes a list of radionuclides that are covered under the 4 millirem beta and the 15 picocuries per liter alpha MCLs. And I think we have a stopping point right now, Dee.
We do. So I do see a few questions that came into the queue, and I'm going to start with this first one. Does the 2575, 25 millirem per year ARAR in 10 CFR 61 automatically meet the risk range, or is a risk assessment still required to show that your risk does not exceed 1 × 10⁻⁴?
You are not required, since that one's considered sufficiently protective, since our own analysis is it corresponds to roughly 10 millirem effective dose.
Okay.
I would say that's discussed in the 1997 guidance. I first talked about the establishment of cleanup levels for surface sites, and it's in one of the two. It's in the attachment B, I think. There's two attachments, A and B. I think it's in B. That issue's discussed.
Okay. One of the participants noted that you mentioned cleanup levels should represent an increased cancer risk of somewhere between 1 times 10 to the minus 6 to 1 times 10 to the minus 4. Does that mean that the cleanup level would be the background concentration plus the risk level corresponding with either cancer risk of, again, 1 times 10 to the minus 6 or 1 times 10 to the minus 4?
No, it's not risk range over background. So for those contaminants that are in background, if they are higher than the risk range, you might actually even be going just to background. That actually happens in some of our radium sites, particularly sites where we have additional exposures, say like tribal sites where people might be living on there a longer period of time and eating more food. So yeah, so it's not say like a lot of the traditional radiation standards, which are dose limit over background. It's actually inclusive of that background for that contaminant, not looking at your, but it's only if those radionuclides are contaminants at that site. So
Do the EPA risk assessment tools also calculate the rad dose from generated progeny like ResRad? How long of a compliance period can they evaluate?
Yeah, they include the ingrowth in decay of progeny, and the new, well, not new, but it's been a few years, but the peak risk option where you're running, say, the PRG calculator, BPRG calculator. I think it analyzed out to, I think it's a billion years. I know it's more than a million, so it
Okay.
goes out far enough.
All right. We have some questions about specific compounds. One of the participants has asked, can you explain the difference between uranium-234, uranium-235, and uranium-238? Is uranium-235 the same as total uranium?
No, total uranium is not by it's looking at uranium in terms of mass, so it's not broken out by isotopes. If you read the preamble to the regulation, they talk about some of the typical amounts of different isotopes you would find, and they thought overall you should this would also still keep the cancer risk down. But in the preamble to that rule and in the guidance, there is discussion that if you have a mixture that's different than what's anticipated, and I can't remember exactly how we described it, it talks about that standard might not be protected. But yeah, I'm sorry, I'd have to get back to you on that. I can't remember exactly the wording on that one.
Okay. How about radon? Can you discuss the difference between using radon 222 versus 226 or others?
Well, 222 and 220 are covered by the UMTRCA standard, so you can use that ARAR. Any of the other ones are you would need to use RISC unless there is some state-specific standard. But I can't think of any national standards that would cover any of the other radons. There's a number of different radons, but we typically don't have them as issues at our sites. We included 219 in the Arvissel calculator because it's come up a couple times, but even that's rarely seen.
Okay.
Although we were looking at expanding the Arvissel for covering additional radons and some other isotopes, but that's a little bit lower priority right now for some other work we're doing.
Okay. And we also, related to radon, we had a comment that came in from another participant just talking about national standards for radon or action levels, and that just all over the world and different organizations have varying numbers, so that it really depends on where you are, what your action level might be. And they shared a few examples of what it is in Switzerland versus the US versus what WHO lists as the action level. So I just wanted to acknowledge that some participants are sharing some of their own resources and references. So I want to thank them for putting those into the queue.
Well, that's a good point too, just because this class is talking about standards that you meet at in the US for CERCLA sites. So even as some people have pointed out in some of the questions, Even in the US, if you were in the NRC regulatory framework, you might be meeting some different standards. And obviously, if you're in other countries, you would be meeting some different standards. So, and I, that's always a good point to make, since I know, particularly even when these are archived, a higher, pretty high percentage of the people that listen to them are outside the US.
Yes, we do have attendees on from Europe. A few visitors from Scotland chimed in earlier. So we do have some international attendees here with us live. So we thank you all for joining us. Stuart, quickly, could you give an example of a recreator?
Recreator. Yeah, so recreators can vary a lot at Superfund sites, but I'd say typical ones you get, you could have in a neighborhood, say in a city or in a town, there could be a local park. And so you might look at people going there frequently, most days, especially when they're kids. People may go there, play sports, may walk around, may hike, may have. And then you might have something that's more like a national park. So you maybe people don't go there as frequent, but when they do go, maybe they stay 2 weeks, and maybe they camp in similar areas for several years. There also may be the recreator that is going out and swimming in a particular area. So that's also looked at. There's different recreators. Once you go into that recreator scenario, there's also people that are doing hunting and fishing. So we can also factor in those, and then you have to start wondering how much the animal that they're hunting and fishing is actually staying in the same spot, and is how much are they on the contaminated area. So you get into a lot of little nuances once you get into that recreator scenario. I just tried to explain a little bit of it, but it's more complicated than I made it out to be. But if you're playing around with the calculator, I would say the one thing on the construction worker and the recreator, there's a lot of site-specific things you have to put in, so you can't really run a generic recreator in those models because they vary so much. A lot of times we have fewer rad sites in a region, and people will talk to me about what they should be using for those kind of scenarios. I'm saying, well, there's typically you've used a recreator maybe at a park, similar park for chemicals, and a lot of the inputs would be the same. So.
Okay. Real quickly, one of the attendees wondered if some of the standards we're discussing, just to reinforce this, are these standards applicable only to the United States, or is there an international standard or convention when it comes to radiological waste?
These are US. I mean, there
Okay.
are some people in other countries and other government officials sometimes like to see what we're doing and think about things that they might be able to incorporate into their own standards or guidance. And I know people sometimes in other countries run the calculators because sometimes they get questions from people in other countries, often government officials who are just trying to compare what they were looking at a site versus what we might do versus what their standards might be, or they might not have their own calculator, so they might be looking at several that are out from different countries and trying to help that inform their cleanup levels at a site in their country.
All right. I think we're going to take a pause here on the Q&A break, but we will come back to it again. I will note that we do have some individuals who have asked questions about how consultation with indigenous peoples might play a role or could change your cleanup goals. And it looks like you're ready to move on to part three, talking about involving stakeholders. So I will just tee that up that there are some questions in the queue on that topic, and I'll turn the floor back to you, Stuart, to carry on with the presentation.
Okay, remind me that when I get to the end, because I'm not going to cover that too well in
Sure.
this one. Keep the expectations low on that. So, but I hope I can cover it more when we go in the Q&A. So, community involvement. So that's very important. Both with tribal stakeholders and pretty much any local community, it's really important that we work to have meaningful involvement by communities at the these contaminated sites. So we have many tools to help facilitate that meaningful involvement. EPA has tools designed specifically to help for use at radiation sites. And EPA, the regions work with stakeholders to develop site-specific tools for local communities, in addition to the tools I'm going to mention here. So these are kind of a starting point, but they are not an end-all be-all. Regions will often need to work with the local community to come up with something more site-specific to help explain some of the things going on. So there's a toolkit, sorry, called the Radiation Risk Assess Superfund Radiation Risk Assessment, a Community Toolkit. This was issued in June 2014. We actually timed it so it would come out at the same time as the risk assessment Q&A. So the big document for our folks to use technically, and then the thing to help them talk to the public at the same time. We wanted to issue them at the same time. So this contains a collection of 22 fact sheets for the general public. And when I say for the general public, that means it's written at basically an eighth grade level. So it supposedly should be really understandable. Contains fact sheets on Superfund and radiation, the Superfund risk assessment process at radiation sites. There's a one pager on each of the six PRG and DCC calculators that I mentioned. There's also an additional fact sheet on the ARVISL calculator that came in after the toolkit, but it's on the homepage for the ARVISL calculator, again at an eighth grade level. And it's a replacement for an earlier Common Radionuclides booklet fact sheet. So. And then there is a video for radiation, Superfund radiation risk assessment, how you can help, an overview. And this is a video for the general public, contains information on the Superfund risk assessment process when addressing radioactive contamination and how the help public can be involved site specifically. So basically, it's similar to one that we did for chemicals, but as we were talking about things like food, right? So this talks about how, gave a couple examples of how people may have food or other types of exposure that we don't normally see that are not built in as a default mode in the risk assessment calculators. And this video is to help people understand about the process and why they should help provide information about things that are going on at the site like that, so we can do a better job on our risk assessment. So if we need to tailor it more site specifically. Also, there may be they may have noticed things in the past, and there may have an idea that there may be contamination buried somewhere that we might not find otherwise. So that so the public being involved in the risk assessment process can help definitely improve the process. Also, it helps, I think, too, if people have a better understanding of what we're doing at the site. So they might have a higher level of confidence. So that video is online. You know, we originally issued on a DVD, but I don't think we have DVD copies anymore. And so all the information, the guidance documents, the risk assessment tools, the models can be run off that website there. So there's little subcategories of cleanup levels and ARRs and the risk assessment. Then that goes to the documents, the models, and the training. There's one another portion on community involvement that takes you to the video and the toolkits on those fact sheets, and then one on the NRC MOU that we have, and also links to the site-specific consultations we've done, and then some other technical guidance that's useful that's been issued by other EPA programs. So, and that is it for me. So, more question time.
All right. So, ladies and gentlemen, this is your time to continue to put those questions into the Q&A window. If you haven't entered them, please go ahead. This is our last Q&A break with our presenter. If you have no questions, you can also put that into the queue. That is equally as helpful to know that you don't have any specific questions for the presenter. But don't worry, Stuart, I have several of them still sitting in the queue. So we're going to start with those and then we'll wait to see if we receive some additional questions.
I didn't think we'd have no questions, you know. I guess that was my guess.
All right. So let's get back to that initial question. One of the attendees had asked earlier if consultation, specifically with Indigenous people, does that change cleanup goals when we're talking about radioactive waste?
I've seen site-specific consultations or working with tribes that have definitely changed the cleanup level. Having additional food choices, there is sometimes a longer period of exposure. So, like for residential We assume someone is at the site 26 years because based on US data, the population changes houses. 90% of the population changes houses within 26 years. And a number of the tribal communities, actually they tend to be less moving around from their houses less. So sometimes I've seen a number of sites where period of exposure is more like 70 or 75 years because high percentage of people just will not move or stay right in the same little area. So we actually had Gene, I think it was 2020 in an intern project, we actually did a Clue-In webinar on that talked about looking at site-specific risk assessments that had additional tribal exposures that were not in those 25 fruits and vegetables and the 10 or 14 farm animals that are in the PRG calculator. And that also looked at state studies. And then we had another intern the next year do additional information because we got more sorts of information that we hadn't done the first year. We didn't do a webinar on that, but those are archived, and I think it's summer of 2020, if I remember right. We could probably add that to the link. But based on information such as that, and then at Waste Management Symposium, which is another, it's kind of a big conference I go to every year. I've been running sessions on Indigenous perspectives on risk assessment. And from that, we've been seeing examples of how there's additional exposure that are not normally captured in the tools. And so we're looking at expanding the choices of animals and plants to put into the calculator. I think we're evaluating 30 animals and 70 plants. So hopefully this year we have an expansion of the calculator. It would probably not be a default, but there'd be choices in the calculator that people could pick to facilitate using those in risk assessment.
Okay. Can you confirm if there is a public or indigenous working group that's set up for each site?
No, I cannot confirm what's done at each site. I
Okay.
just, I, for me, I don't monitor sites. I am brought in for specific questions. So when people
Okay.
need help on their risk assessment or their ARARs, they bring me in, and then I might talk with them very heavily for a period of time, and then not talk to them for several years or at all if they don't have similar issues that I work on. So.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll move along to some additional questions. Here's one about policy. The participant states that it's my understanding that EPA policies at rad mine sites is to leave the waste on site and not to remove it off site. Is that correct?
No, it's a site-specific determination. There are some sites where contamination is taken off the site. There are sometimes there's on-site waste management. I'll just say that on-site waste management at Superfund sites, there is a policy, a consultation policy where the regions talk with headquarters, which is me, and then we talk. I talk with my management about the specific circumstances at the site to see if there's an issue. As we talked before at the beginning of the training, how radioactive contamination, there can be strong public feelings, and management wrote that guidance back in 2000 because they wanted to have generally a heads up if there might be an issue, if there's going to be any on-site waste management. But it's not a policy that we are always taking waste from sites and taking it, disposing it off site, or that we're disposing it on site. That's a site-specific determination for mine sites and other types of radiation sites or other Superfund sites in general.
Okay. All right. Our next question, the risk calculator, does that estimate how much plant and animal uptake there is of uranium and radium? Does EPA have any studies or concrete data on uranium and radium uptake in plants and animals?
Yes, for most of the contaminants, I think so. When you're running the calculators, there's 1,252 radio, 52 or 58 radionuclides in the calculator. For most of them, particularly for things like radium, which is more commonly studying uranium. There is data on plant uptake or uptake from eating plants or drinking water into the various farm animals. I won't say that there's data for each plant, but yes, there's usually, and for the radionuclides, these are based on measured data, so there are lots of studies on this, much more than on the chemical side. So the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, they work to put together, it's actually their second document, TRS-472, which is a set of recommendations based on large numbers of studies on plant uptake into the roots of these into these plants from different elements. And they break that down into about 8, 10 different plant categories, and then we tried to match that up with the categories of plants that we had information on ingestion from the Exposure Factors Handbook. So we cite back to that document in the user guide, where they were not, they did not have information for some plants or some radionuclides. We used information generally from the United Kingdom Environment Agency, which had a database also of, and we worked with the co-chair of the IAEA work group when trying to put together this scheme on how to address plants and animals, along with our person who was the lead at the Exposure Factors Handbook, who's now retired, on how to on trying to split these up. So we do have data on that from, so there are two or authoritative sources, one from IAEA and one from the Exposure Handbook, on looking at plant uptake and then looking at ingestion rates. The thing where we also use the mass loading factors, just to, because there's a different amount of dirt that will get on, say, a, you know, absorb onto an onion versus an orange. To me, that's more plant specific. And the United Kingdom Environment Agency had was the only place that I knew of that actually had gone through and done different mass loading factors for different plants in gardens. They had like 5 or 6 plants, so we used their same scheme. A lot of that work was from Tom Hinton, who's at now at Fukushima University, but it was at the French nuclear, the French research agency IRSN. So we worked with him also on trying to update that to get more plants in and get more specific mass loading factors. So, and that's all explained in a technical manual that was issued by DOE's Oak Ridge National Lab, which works with us on the calculators. There's a link to that in the user guide, so it explains where we got the information from. There is a new IAEA document, or newer, that we're looking at incorporating that has more transfer factors for arid environments and tropical environments. So hopefully we'll be updating these as in the future.
All right. Can you answer this one? How does cow or cattle PRG consider cows consumed? For example, subsistence farming versus cattle set to a feedlot before going to the mass market.
So the farmer scenario is looking more at a subsistence farmer. So if you want to look at somebody who might be, say, a rancher, actually, we actually have looked at, I'd say, site specifically rancher scenarios. Believe that they still end up using similar ingestion rate. So if you're protective of the person who's growing it and eating a large amount of cattle, then it'd be protective for someone if they were eating less amount of that cattle because it was being shipped all over the place. But as far as looking at things like population effects, we don't do that at Superfund. So yeah, the where someone has looked at, say, the ranch scenario, even if it's not their house is not there, we look at the rancher eating a fair amount of the cattle. And that's been a some couple site specific risk assessments that I've reviewed from different regions.
Okay. All right, so let's take a look at I think this is back to the model. When you're talking about plant uptakes in desert climates, would users select a temperate climate when modeling this?
Currently, the idea is that we will eventually have arid and semi-arid as choices
Okay.
because we have more specific transfer factors that have been issued by IEA. I mean, so we're looking at incorporating that as we also expand the number of plants at the same time.
Can you expand a bit about ways or additional exposure pathways that EPA has added or is considering to account for the unique components of indigenous lifestyles? They're wondering if there's a fact sheet or summary of how EPA accounts for this.
I've not seen a fact sheet that would compare. Well, the only I've s seen that we put together in a general sense, and not a site-specific sense, was the two intern papers that were up there, and those were looking at additional plants. I think they had a little bit of ceremonial exposures in there, but yeah, I've seen. At some sites, there have been some additional ceremonial exposure or other types of exposure, such as like sweat lodges, also applying material to your body as part of a ceremony. Those, but having other than what we documented in the intern papers, and even what I've seen sometimes that information in a study. It's a lot of times because it's a ceremony, it's hard to get any of the underlying information because it's not something that the tribe is wants to have released. So there were there I've seen examples that did not show up in the intern paper because the tribe did not want to release the information. So we would ask the researcher or and they would generally say, no, the tribes asked me not to release that information. Or they would check and they would say, no, I'm told I could not release that. So.
Let's talk about border waterways. Is there a separate set of risk factor assessments that are used for ecological impacts from sediments?
Oh, for protecting biota, we, EPA, have not issued a calculator for protecting biota. We have one that's in draft and installed for years. Might be getting ready to restart it as I finish up another calculator that's in front of it. But there are other tools out there. I often see people use the phased approach that's in some documents from ORNL. They're internationally, ERICA's quite popular as a model that's developed by some of the European and South American governments and universities. And then there's from DOE, there's also ResRide Biota that's also used. So, but we, EPA Superfund does not have a tool yet.
Okay.
Hopefully that'll change in a year or so.
All right. I am going to go back to a question that we had about licensing. One of the participants asked very early on, how are the substantive requirements enforced for radiological licensing under CERCLA permit exemptions? So, for example, a license isn't required. Does the state or NRC review requirements to meet those license requirements?
Well, yes, we don't. So on site, we don't require permits or licenses. But if that facility is licensed by NRC, they would still have that license. And so, when we're doing our CERCLA action, ideally, if it's an NRC license or an agreement state license, the region would also be coordinating with NRC or that agreement state on their decommissioning, so that hopefully there would be one cleanup action that would achieve both sets of criteria, so the CERCLA criteria and the NRC or the state agreement state criteria. So we wouldn't have a cleanup for CERCLA or cleanup for the Atomic Energy Act, and then, 2 years later to clean up the same spot for the other authority. So you'll see coordination among the agencies to try and avoid issues like that. But that tends to get into a lot more site-specific issues and how much there might be variation between the site-specific cleanup criteria between the two agencies. But my experience has been they've been able to generally work through those issues.
Okay, all right, let's swap out to some more technology-specific questions. Can you talk briefly about disposal of radioactive materials? They state that WIPP is supposedly not going to accept materials past 2040 or so. So they're wondering, do you see any additional technological disposal options in the future, on-site, off-site? What do you see when you look into your crystal ball?
Uncertainty on that, so I probably shouldn't start widely speculating on how that might or might not look in the future. But
Okay.
yes, disposal is an issue. You often see on the rad side, there's not as many disposal options, and disposal costs tend to be pretty expensive. So it's disposal is challenging on radiation.
Okay. Does EPA consider soil mixing a valid remedial technique for reducing radioactive concentration levels?
You mean trying to characterize this as soil mixing for mixing of clean and contaminated soil so you can spread it around and be below a certain level? Is that what they're?
I believe that's what they're describing.
Yeah, I believe we've criticized that heavily in the past. Part of the thing on the whole idea is why we don't do things like population effects. If we protect the individual, the thought is by cleaning up, we would therefore protect the population. So if you get down to a level within the risk range, you would have protected everyone. But if you take the same amount of contamination, same contamination level, then you just mix it with clean material and then you spread it around and you expose more people, you're still going to have the same type of, you could still have like similar type of cancer effects in the population that you did if you never cleaned up at all. So, yeah, that's been looked at. I know I won't go into detail, but I know a couple of times we've written some pretty negative comments on people considering that approach.
Okay. All right. We had an attendee who wanted to circle back about EPA Chapter 5 and EPA CERCLA compliance with other laws in Manual Part 2. The Clean Air Act and other environmental statutes and state requirements. This is quoting from an OSWER directive from 1989, directive number 9234.1-2. They say this speaks specifically to including 10 CFR Part 20. They're wondering if you could confirm, because it sounded like earlier you were saying it should not be included. So, which is it?
There are a couple things that were in that in the earlier compliance with other laws manuals. I think, but a while since I looked at that language, that updated guidance had different viewpoints and changed some of the policy in there. I know when they did the compliance with other laws manual, they talked about NAAQS being ARARs, but they're not enforceable, so they couldn't be ARARs because the compliance with other laws manual was written before the NCP came out, and so some of the ARAR discussion is updated and changed and revised with future guidance. So the thought that the 25 millimeter was outside the risk range really was determined by EPA early 1997 in a letter back to NRC, and then that was then implemented in the guidance that came out in August of that year. So it was that thought and that assessment had not been done when the Compliance with Our Laws manual came out in 1989. I guess that 1989 is part two. I think 88 is part one. But yeah, that's it. Just predates the determination that those numbers were outside the risk range.
Okay. All right. I'm going to go back to a question about risk assessment model changes. And they're just curious, are these risk assessment models accounting for changes in climate?
You mean a climate change? No.
Okay.
I don't. I'm not sure if any of the our models are not accounting for climate change.
Okay. All right. And then I'll just acknowledge as well, one of the attendees provided a comment that blending of those contaminated soils is approved, but only to meet the WAC or WAC at the disposal site. So just sharing that comment from the participant. All right. I see two more questions in the queue, Stuart, and then we might be able to wrap it up. So I'm going to take these last two and see if anything else comes in.
Okay.
This one is related to a brownfields grant. So, by all means, let me know if this is beyond the scope of our talk today. One of the participants wondered if brownfields grants could be used to help remediate properties that are contaminated with low-level radioactive material. So, there's no chemical or hazardous materials present. And the levels of radioactive materials are so low that they don't trigger a Superfund status.
I don't know. I don't really know much about brownfields. I know I've answered some technical questions on brownfield sites, but
Okay.
not knowing the scope of them and when there might be an issue if they're at a certain level. I just don't know that.
Okay. And for the questioner, if you'd like to, feel free to send me an email directly. I can point you to some individuals in the Brownfields program here at EPA that might be able to help track down an answer for you. All right. In this last question, Stuart, do you have any comments on total metal or uranium total metal versus uranium dissolved metal?
I do not. It's all I can say is that when in the RSL calculator, I don't see it's best. I don't see it broken out that way. So I don't have any other thoughts on that. And that calculator is actually run by a completely different person. It's a chemical toxicity. So I actually don't even work on that issue.
Okay. All right. Well, at this time, I don't see any other questions in the queue. So, Stuart, I'll offer a closing opportunity if there are any final reminders or statements you want to leave them with before I walk through our closeout procedures for today.
No, I hope I didn't put people to sleep, and I'm glad a lot of people were able to show up.
Right. Excellent. Thank you so much, Stuart. I appreciate your time and your expertise. And I can assure you, I've already gotten multiple comments. You did not put anyone to sleep. They were all very excited to have you here and to participate in this talk. I'm going to take back control here and I'll walk through just a few final closing reminders before I send everyone on their way. So, again, I want to thank Stuart as well as the over 240 individuals who joined us from all over the world for today's live broadcast of the EPA Superfund Remedial Program's approach for addressing radioactive contamination. I'm going to walk through a series of quick final reminders to again let you know how you can learn more about this topic, access contact information, get a certificate, get to the recording. I will walk through all of that just now. So the first thing I will do is encourage you to visit us at the Cleanup Information Network or cluein.org website. And when you go there, make sure you sign up for our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct. I send that out on the first of each month and will highlight free online technical training opportunities such as today's session, as well as other new publications, case studies, websites, and events related to characterization and cleanup of hazardous waste sites. If you would like to learn more, Stuart is going to come back for another webinar on Cluin on May 22nd. So if you haven't already done so, I encourage you to sign up for the next delivery. And this particular session will focus on the Superfund Remedial Program's approach for risk harmonization when addressing chemical and radioactive contamination at sites. Again, that webinar is scheduled on May 22nd from 1:30 to 3:30 p.m. Eastern. So please be sure to sign up and register if you have not. You'll find that again on the Cluin website. Now, if you were not with me at the very beginning of the seminar, I'll just remind everyone there is a unique seminar homepage. That URL is shown in red at the top of this slide. That website is available from today forward. On that homepage, there are a series of sections that will contain information about our talk, contact information for our speaker, links to download his presentation materials, as well as a collection of additional resources to publication, guidance, models, videos, all the things that Stuart was highlighting in his presentation. We have those all actively hyperlinked on this website. You may find it helpful to scroll up and down or use the plus and minus sign on the far right to collapse or expand sections. For those of you who are looking for copies of, again, the presentation content, we have already posted it. And if you would like a participation certificate to indicate your attendance in today's session, visit the seminar homepage and fill out that online feedback form. When you fill in the online feedback form, there will be a box at the bottom of the form that will allow you to self-certify you are here for today's entire live delivery. So when you check that box and submit your feedback, you'll then have immediate access to either download or print out a certificate of participation. I will also email a copy to you, but honestly, many times people report that those get caught in junk or spam filters. So I strongly encourage you to download it right from that confirmation screen. If you happen to host a viewing party at your location and multiple people joined, please simply make sure you send them that URL to the seminar homepage. It's the same page you went to register. It's the same page we sent in our reminder emails. It's the same place I sent you to when checking in today. Just share that URL. They can scroll down to the feedback form, and each person can fill out that feedback form based on their own opinions of the session, checking the box to certify they were here for the whole thing. And as soon as they submit the form, they'll have their own certificate of participation in their name, even though they didn't register individually. So I do encourage you to share that. If you happen to be one of the lucky people watching the recorded version of the webinar, guess what? You can still visit that website and share feedback, checking the box to indicate you watched the entire archive, and then get your own certificate of participation based on your replay of the session. So if you are one of the lucky people watching the recorded version of today's webinar, right about now in the upper corner above my head, there should be a button in the archived version that will point to the seminar feedback form. Simply click that, fill it out, making sure to check the box that you were here for the whole replay, and then submit it to have access to your own certificate. So again, materials and links are posted on that seminar homepage. Contact information for Stuart is also posted there. And if you're looking for a certificate of participation, we do strongly welcome and encourage you to submit that feedback form to share your thoughts. I'll send an automatic email to each of you when that archive is available for free on-demand playback. And I hope that you'll join us for a future session, particularly the one coming up in May, where Stuart will be back again for another presentation. With that, I'll thank each and every one of you for joining us. We hope that you found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time, and we'll see you on a future seminar. Thanks so very much for joining us.